How are you holding up? Sometimes these conferences can be a little like trying to drink out of a fire hydrant. It's all coming at you all at once and take a while to sort of digest, I know, but hang in there. It's worthwhile. For those of you who don't know, I'm John Hodges. I am a board member of Westminster Academy. If I were really smart, I'd get you to turn to my biography in there and add that to my biography. My bio leaves that off. But I'm one of the founding board members of Westminster Academy with my wife, Day. And I'm proud to be able to say that. I think the school has been a tremendous blessing already in the 5 years that we've been meeting. We graduated our second class this past spring, and it's been a great success, I think. As you know, if you've been working on these schools, it's a lot of hard work, and I give a lot of credit to my colleagues and on the board. They should be up here to receive the sort of attention that I end up getting because I'm doing the talk, but my colleagues not only have done a great job of running this school, but have also done a very good job, I think, of putting this conference together, and I'd like to give them a round of applause, if you don't mind. As they will get, I'm sure, thanks on a more official level by all of the folks later on, but they have done great work indeed. This talk is the sort of theoretical talk that yesterday's Les Mis talk was practical. I'm interested in trying to get the beginnings, anyway, down of how we might think through a Christian aesthetic. What is it about Christianity that lends itself to beauty? Aesthetics, as you know, is the specific area of the study of the beautiful. It's a subset of philosophy. In philosophy, you study other things. The good, the true, for example. But also the beautiful. When you study the good, you might be dealing with ethics. When you study the true, you might be dealing with epistemology. But when you deal with the third, the beautiful, you're dealing in the study of aesthetics. And the question I have is, how does one go about evaluating something in terms of its beauty? Now, I tell you a quick story. When I teach at college, I often take my students and ask them this question. Imagine somebody you know very well, your roommate, your best friend, your father, your mother, your brother, sister, somebody you know very well, comes to you and says, I just heard this CD, and it's really good. What do you hear from that? What does that mean to you? And then I take my chalk up and I write down on the blackboard everything they tell me. And they immediately say things like, he liked it. Okay? I'll put that down over here. He liked it. Somebody else will say, my friend felt good when he heard it. So it feel good. And then they'll go on into detail about that, like he felt elated, or he felt moved, or it impressed him somehow that way. So he enjoyed it that way. And I keep putting these things down, you see. And I get a list of, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 things before somebody says, it was well played. And then I purposefully go over to this side of the board and I write down, well played. You know, so we have this long list over here and well played over here. And I don't comment about it, I just do it. And we go on for some more and we get another five or six on this side. And then somebody says, it was well composed. And I walk carefully over here and I put down, well composed over here. Well played, well composed. And eventually somebody will say, my friend agreed with the content of it, the statement that it was trying to make, theologically or something. Or maybe disagreed with it, maybe because he said it was not good. Then I'll go over here and put that down. And when the fire's boiled down, when it's burned down, usually that's what I come up with. Three things on this side of the board. All these things that speak about the subject, that is, the person who heard the music, I felt this when I heard it, or whatever. And over here, the three things, really only three, basically, that are about the object, that is, the artwork itself. It somehow has the characteristics of good composition. It somehow has the characteristics of being well played, performed well, or it has something inherently in it that's worthwhile theologically or something like that. And I ask them the question, why do you suppose I've separated these two out? And, of course, to make a long story short, they eventually get the idea that I'm talking about the subjective versus the objective. Now, those are the definitions I'm using here. There are several definitions for those words. Let me make sure I make it clear. When I speak about the subjective in aesthetics, I'm speaking about those things that describe the hearer, the response of the hearer, the subject in the sentence. I liked it. But when I talk about the objective in aesthetics, I'm talking about those things that describe the object, the it, as opposed to those things that describe the viewer. So, when somebody comes to you and says, this CD is good, he might be telling you that he thinks the work is inherently worthwhile by the way it was composed, or the way it was performed, or something about it. Or he might be telling you how he felt when he heard it. The same word good often gets used to describe either, both, or some combination of those two things, you see. Either one of those two things or a combination of those two things. So you don't really know right off the bat when he says this is good whether he's telling you something about himself or he's telling you something about the object. Now, as we go through here, you'll begin to see I'm not going to try and tell you that one or the other of those is altogether the only way you understand beauty. But my point as I go is going to be that our day and age specifically has 25 or 30 ways to evaluate subjectively and only two or three to evaluate objectively. And those two or three are not the first things that come to our minds when we consider whether or not something's worthwhile aesthetically. In other words, we live in a relativistic age that encourages subjective thinking about beauty. We live in a relativistic age that encourages subjective thinking about beauty. Now, that's not to say that subjective thinking about beauty is inherently bad, but when it's not coupled with an understanding of and an evaluation of the object, we're led astray. And I think that's what's happened. This, I think, can connect with some of the things that Doug was saying yesterday, in that we don't even have often the basics of how to approach, in music, musical terms, how to approach the grammar of music, how to read music, how to understand it, how to listen to it, that sort of thing, in order to be able to objectively evaluate the things that we listen to and not simply respond emotionally or subjectively to them. So, I'm fully in favor of Doug's call for us to consider education in music. But I'm speaking about music here, I think all these principles can be applied in general to the arts as well. So let me give you a sort of whirlwind history of aesthetics. We pop back to the Greeks, and I hope at a classical Christian school conference that won't be a bad thing to do. When we look at music in particular and art in general in the minds of the Greeks, there were two Greek gods that especially inspired thinking about aesthetics. One was Apollo. Apollo was because so much of music and art and so on has always been associated with worship. The worship of the gods are central in Greek thinking to the way we view aesthetics. I'll tell you a little bit about Apollo. Apollo was the god of light. I don't mean light from the sun. I mean metaphorical light, the light of reason, the light of order, the light of inspiration, the light of the light that you get from contemplation. So worship in the Apollonian temple included music played on the on the lyre, which is the precursor to the harp, and that music was monody, what we call monody, that is, it had only one line to it. Now, we don't know a whole lot about Greek music, but we know a few little things. We can't actually read Greek music because we don't have enough information about it, but we can get a few ideas about it. There was a melody, and that melody was not only sung, but it was played by this lyre, this harp-like instrument. Well, the music in worship of Apollo was contemplative. It was reflective. It was orderly. It was inspired by a lot of the sort of what we consider to be Platonic ideals. That is, they think in terms of order and balance and symmetry and order. You get the idea. Things are rational. If you've spent any time thinking about Greek art, you know the Parthenon is orderly in its construction, and that was inspired greatly by this same sort of mindset. Well, the other great Greek god that inspired music in particular, but art in general, was Dionysus. Now, Dionysus is in many ways the opposite of Apollo. Dionysus was the god of nature and of the vines and growing things, and so by extension, he's the god of grapes and wine. And the Roman equivalent of Dionysus was Bacchus. You know about Bacchanalia and so on. Well, Dionysus was inspired worship that was quite different as well. So the art and the style of worship in the Dionysian temple was very emotive, of the heart, of the emotions, of the experience, of the here and now, and that sort of thing. In fact, Dionysian temple worship was included things like drug use for higher states of consciousness. The music of the Dionysian temple was more emotionally based and was played on an instrument called the aulos, A-U-L-O-S, and it was music that was, the aulos is the precursor to the flute. It's sort of like a pan flute. Have you seen those? Reed sort of flutes that are knitted together sort of by weeds and things. They would wrap the pipes together and they'd get different lengths, and so you get different pitches. So it was music that was encouraging emotional responses to things, so that the Dionysian temple worship was emotionally based music. And drugs were used to heighten consciousness, I said. And actually, temple prostitution was a big part of the Dionysian worship service, if you remember all about that. The New Testament speaks about it occasionally. And when it occurred to me, as I was thinking about this, the really only difference between Dionysian temple worship and the modern university campus in our day and age, and with its rock music and its drug abuse and its, you know, temple prostitution, is that the ancient Greeks knew how to speak Greek. Well, what I bring to you is that these two gods inspired two somewhat different views of the place and the purpose of music. One thought in terms of ideals, the other in terms of particulars. One thought in terms of reason and the head, if you will, contemplation. The other thought in terms of the heart and emotions, and so on. There's a sort of dichotomous view that comes forth from these two gods. And so you can think of, you know, Apollo, head, reason, form, order, ideals. Dionysus is involved with the opposites in the sense of those, emotion, the natural, the particulars of this world. If you've ever seen, you remember the famous Raphael painting of the School of Athens? Have you seen it? Where Plato is pointing up, Plato and Aristotle are standing right next to each other, and Plato's pointing up like this, and Aristotle is pointing out like this. There's something of the Apollonian-Dionysian sort of split in that picture, where the two of them are, one talking about ideals, the other about particulars, you see. Well, you can imagine how if you took one or the other of these two views of music, you would come up with quite a different set of pieces of music that you'd compose, or paintings that you would paint, or sculpture that you would create. Well, the history of the modern world, really, from the Renaissance onward, is a very clear, I think, history, generally speaking, of the pendulum swing between those two sort of extremes. If you think about the beginning of the Renaissance, the High Renaissance anyway, in Florence and in Rome, you find the picture that they had was a rather Apollonian picture. toward the end of the Renaissance, you see a more Dionysian picture in the Mannerists and so on, painters I'm thinking about. The pendulum, though, swings from the more Apollonian, idealized, think about portraits of the Mona Lisa or even earlier than that, Fra Angelico or some of the early Renaissance painters. There's sort of a balance and symmetry and clarity and order and calmness to the works. There's a revival of Greek architecture where you see the statues standing contrapposto, as they say, one knee bent, all the weight on the other knee, on the other leg, very much like the Greek statues. And you think about Michelangelo's David and you find exactly the same sort of thing. That sort of classical Apollonian approach. On the other hand, as you go through the years into the 1700s, you find the 1600s and 1700s, you find the Baroque period beginning, and the art and the architecture and the sculpture and the music in particular are quite Dionysian. Instead of the sort of Donatello David, where he's standing very calmly contrapposto, you find the Berninis and the Borrominis creating statues that are turned and twisted and in motion and so on, very much like late sort of Hellenistic Greek statues that imply a more Dionysian, active, moment to moment, day to day life kind of approach to their art. The music of the Baroque period is very much like that too. The music of the Renaissance, you think of Palestrina at the end of the Renaissance in a very sort of clarified, orderly bit of composition, and think at the end of the Baroque period in Handel, just the opposite, where there's lots of filigree, lots of emotion painted. The words themselves become very important, and the expression of the music is based purely or mainly on how you can get those emotive character of the words across. I'll give you a quick example. I don't want to take a lot of time because really I should play the examples for you, and if I did, we would take too long. The emotive value in music is considered under Handel and Bach and many of the late Baroque composers in that they do what they call tone painting. Have you noticed that a lot of the music of Handel, for example, you know, Messiah, let me give you a quick example. How about the tenor aria from Messiah? The first tenor aria is "Every valley shall be exalted." Do you know that? "Every valley shall be exalted." Well, he says in the music what the words mean. He's actually trying to get you to feel the words. He says, shall be exalted, like that, or something like that. I'm not a... the crooked straight, and the rough places plain. You see? What does exalted mean, anyway? Lift it up. It's being lifted up, you see? I'm butchering poor Handel's music here. But you get the idea. I mean, if you go back and listen to Messiah with that in mind and understand that every time he says something, he's trying to get the music to express to you what the meaning of the words are, then you'll think you'll hear it in a whole different way. Bach is the same way. If you listen back through the B minor Mass, you'll find all sorts of examples of that same sort of thing. Well, what I'm really trying to outline here for you is this pendulum swing between the Apollonian and the Dionysian over the course of the last 500, 600 years. So you've got Renaissance Apollonianism that swings into Baroque Dionysianism. At the end of the Baroque, things are so involved and so passionate and so expressive and all that, people say, "Golly, give us a little clarity, a little sanity, a little, you know." And so you find that there's a neoclassical movement in art in the beginning of the middle of the 1700s, leading all the way up to 1800 or so. And we call that neoclassical in painting, paintings of David and paintings of Ingres and Benjamin West and people like that. On the musical side, you find music of people like Haydn and Mozart and so on. Clarity, order, precision, all that stuff plays in again. It's not surprising that it's at that point that archaeology is born, because what they really were doing is digging up Pompeii and digging up Herculaneum and other places, and they were finding what it was like to live in ancient Rome. See? So the ancient Roman and Greek ideas were resurfacing at that point, fascinating a lot of people, and the result was that we have a neoclassical sort of rebirth in the middle of the 18th century. Well, in the 19th century, the pendulum swings back again to a more Dionysian approach with the Romantics. We were talking about Victor Hugo yesterday, another good example of a Romantic composer. Late Beethoven's music is very Romantic. Schubert, Mendelssohn, Brahms, Wagner, Liszt, all those fellas are all Romantics. The same thing happens in the paintings of people like Delacroix. Delacroix and Géricault, the French painters, Goya, and other Romantic painters. You'll see some of the same sorts of things. Well, the principles are that they are, once again, more involved and more interested in the Dionysian immediacy of experiences, and if you take that principle and apply it to those guys, you'll see it all, and I won't need to outline it. But if you want to try and remember these names and go back and look for them, that's the thing to do rather than spend all my time giving examples. Forgive me. Anyway, there's this pendulum swing. You'd think then after the end of the Romantic period that there would be a pendulum swing back again at the beginning of the 20th century, and sure enough, that's what happens. I think the painting and the music of the Impressionists at the end, the latter part of the 19th century, is very much objective. Many people think of that as the sort of quintessential pretty music, but really it was a very scientific approach to painting and a very scientific approach to composition. Where sounds and light and so on are studied for their own sake. And suddenly we're very cold again, very sort of calculating and orderly. And that ushers in, I think, the beginning of the 20th century, a great deal of interest in neoclassical thinking. You find neoclassical painting. In Picasso, he goes through a period where he paints Greek figures. You see, in the music of people like Stravinsky and Prokofiev, and Arthur Honegger and Erik Satie and people like that, a rejection of the sort of super romantic music of the end of the 19th century, people like Mahler and Bruckner and Richard Strauss and people like that. There's a reaction against their super romanticism, and you find it in the sort of dry, witty music of Stravinsky and the dry cleverness of an orderliness and symmetry of Satie and some of these others. So you see this pendulum swing back and forth, at least. Now, as you get into the 20th century, things sort of decay because many, many schools are born. It's harder to make generalizations. We could do it, but I won't do it here. But all I want you to do is see that general swing. I would like to introduce, though, into the conversation that this head versus heart, reason versus emotion, Greek picture from Apollo and Dionysus that has inspired for so long so much of our thinking is inherently not good. It's not a picture in the, when I say not good, I mean it's not accurate. The truth is the aesthetics is a combination of those two things. It's not an either or sort of question. And the pendulum swing back and forth has often been forced precisely because people are encouraged to take that as an either-or dichotomy. And I don't think that's necessary. So what we have in the end is, I think, woven throughout this history of the last 500-600 years is a better picture for a basis for aesthetics. And that, of course, plays right into the Christian's hands. It's an incarnational picture of aesthetics. You see, in Jesus we find the perfect, the ideal, and the particular simultaneously, immediately. You see? Both of the things that the Greeks are longing for are found in him. He is at once the God who has created all things, and from whom and through whom and to whom all things are. And a specific man at a particular time with certain feelings incarnated in Jesus Christ at a particular day and age in that history of the world. It's It's almost as though he came to fulfill exactly what they were longing for and couldn't get out of either side of their dichotomy. Well, it's almost, it is exactly that. So the picture of aesthetics that the Christian should take, I think, should not start with the Greeks, except to say, as I've said, to understand the history of the last 600 years. It's not that the Christian picture of aesthetics has been lost altogether, but especially since the Enlightenment, I think it's been sidelined to such a degree that we don't really take it seriously. And the result is that the church, without thinking, has embraced a very Greek picture, in the worst sense of the word Greek. I mean, I agree with a lot of things that Plato and Aristotle teach, so don't get me, I'm not trying to bashing Greeks here. But when they were mistaken, their mistakes, when adopted, are devastating to our thinking. Let me read you a few writers who support this. I think I've given you a sense for Apollonian and Dionysian. Let me read you a few writers themselves who support this picture of the importance of seeing beauty as an objective thing as well as a subjective experience. That the two of those things fit together. Because you see, I guess I've left this piece of the puzzle out. Hang on just a second before I do that. Once you have this Apollonian Dionysian picture in your mind, I think you can make a parallel. It's not exact, but I think you can draw a parallel to this subjective-objective picture that I've drawn for you to begin with. That is, that the Apollonian lends itself to an analysis of the object better, and the Dionysian lends itself to an analysis of the subjective better. And as a result, the two things are kind of in parallel track to one another. So what I would like to do is, my goal in this lecture and in most of the work I'm doing with college students and with ACCS work and writing and so on, is I would like to reintroduce the concept that the objective is a serious consideration when we deal with this aesthetics. I said at the beginning, our culture is deeply saturated with relativistic thinking, and the result is that even Christians, when they don't think like Christians, adopt a relativistic picture about aesthetics, and the easiness of the subjective side is perfectly accommodating. You see, once you buy a relativism, and then if you have a decision between the objective and the subjective, well, there's no choice. You go to the subjective, because in the end, it's only a matter of how I perceive things anyway. Do you see? Relativism says my truth and your truth may be very different. Well, what can I go by then? What authority do I claim? My own experience. When I look at that picture, I feel X. You see? Now, a little corollary. Here's what happens in the church. And the same point. This philosophy is very practical in the sense that it happens in the church all the time. You hear this sort of sentence all the time. I don't feel like I've worshipped unless I hear blank. Talking about music. Don't you hear that? I don't feel like I've really worshipped unless we sing the great hymns of the faith. I don't feel like I've really worshipped unless we have a few of those contemporary Christian songs. You know, scripture songs or whatever you want to call them. You know what I mean? I don't feel like I've... And I'm going to get to kind of come back to that in a minute, because I think that the problem with that is not the blank. The problem with that is that I feel. You see? Now I'll get back to that. So, let me read you some supporting material encouraging us all to reconsider from our own history of philosophers in the past that beauty is more than just in the eye of the beholder. It's not a matter only for our own personal experience. When the I'll read Plato first. The application of beauty in music. Plato leads us to understanding of the good. The connection in his mind is not simply separate good and beautiful. He thinks, actually, that understanding and learning to appreciate the beautiful leads us to an appreciation of the virtuous. In the third book of the Republic, he says this, quote, musical training is a more potent instrument than any other because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul on which they mightily fasten. imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful, or of him who is less educated ungraceful. And also because he who has received this true education of the inner being will most shrewdly perceive omissions or faults in art or nature. And with a true taste, while he praises and rejoices over and receives into his soul the good, and becomes himself noble and good, he will justly blame and hate the bad. Now, in the days of his youth, even before he's able to know the reason why, and when reason comes, he will recognize and salute the friend with whom his education has made him long familiar. End quote. Plus for music education in the young. And this reminds me of Lorenzo's famous line in Merchant of Venice, Act 5, Scene 1. He tells Jessica this: "The man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as a rebus. Let no such man be trusted." Mark the music, he says. Isn't that great? Aristotle, in his Metaphysics, says this: the chief forms of beauty are, you ever wanted to know? Chief forms of beauty are order and symmetry and definiteness. Remember those three words, because Thomas Aquinas will draw on those later on. And he says, or Aristotle says, these three things are understood from science. So there's a direct connection between what is beautiful and what is observed by way of science. Order, symmetry, definiteness. Some translators in Thomas say is clarity, the third one, definiteness or clarity. Augustine wrote that beauty in art and the creation reflects something of divine beauty. There's an order in God that's reflected in the arts, he says. The less sensible the artwork, the closer it is to mirroring the divine. And that means, he says, that music then is really better than sculpture and painting, because it's less sensible. That is, you can't touch it, you know? Music is only in the air, and it's perceived by the ear. There's nothing tangible. Not literally, but you know what I mean. You can't grasp it and hold it like you can a stone that's been carved or a painting. And he argues that the scriptures then are even better than music, because the Holy Spirit has inspired them, crafted the words of scripture to reflect the nature of God. Let me jump ahead to Jonathan Edwards. I'll skip a couple here. Jonathan Edwards argued that there's an important connection, too, between the nature of God's virtuous character and the secondary beauty of created things. Edwards argued,
you know that the invitation system of going forward to receive Christ at the end of a service is not part of the historic Christian liturgy. Christians have not done this until the early part of the 19th century, when Charles Finney invented it as a part of a worship service. He called it the anxious bench, where close the deal right away. You get people to come, strike while the iron was hot, and you get them to come forward and rededicate or join the church or become a Christian or whatever. He had this thing called the anxious bench. Well, the invitation system grew out of that. And Charles Spurgeon was no friend of the invitation system, which was just coming in to English churches.
Health is beautiful, and that when he creates things, they then have they take innumerable instances. And especially to establish inferior things with analogy to superior things. Thus, in how many instances has he formed brutes in analogy to the nature of mankind? And plants in analogy to animals? And with respect to the manner of their generation, nutrition, and etc., they are similar that way. Why such analogy in God's works pleases him, it is not needful now to inquire. It is sufficient that he makes an agreement of different things in their form, manner, measure, etc., to appear beautiful, because here, in doing so, is some image of a higher kind of agreement and consent of spiritual beings. End quote. What Edwards is getting at is that there is an order and a relationship and a community even within the Trinity that serves as the highest example of all that he creates. So there is an order and unity and community within the creation that he makes. And when we stumble across that, we find it beautiful. Because God himself is what beauty is. See? The nature of beauty is bound up in the mystery that is the nature of God himself. Edwards argues that the nature of the mutual consent of the Godhead is reflected in the consent and harmony of the elements of his creation. And that music then, and the order and harmony of music, is actually reflecting the nature of the order and harmony of God himself. Now, let me tell you a little side story here. Interesting sort of word study. I love to take words apart and find out where they came from and what they mean and so on. And you've heard of the muses. We're all classical people here. You know the nine muses? Well, they were inspirational, weren't they? I mean, they were to give people who were writing plays or writing music or building buildings or writing poetry or whatever creative work that man did that was significant work, was inspired by the muses. So music, you see, is actually a broader term than simply what we talk about sometimes today. It can be at least used in a broader term, that which is inspired by the muses. Well, we have another word. We put the negative prefix a in front of muse to say what the opposite of muse, or that which is inspired by the muses, is. To amuse someone is to take them offline for a moment, if you will, you see, to take them away from the significant work that they're doing that is inspired by the muses, and for a momentary bit of rest, be diverted, you see? That's what amusement means. So an amusement park is not something you do every day. It's something that you do when you stop work and take a little break and so on. Well, here's the irony of it all. We now today in the 21st century use music to amuse people. Does that strike you as ironic? We use music to entertain us when we're not doing the things that are important. When we're standing in line at the grocery store or sitting waiting for the bus or, you know what I mean? We play music through little speakers at us all day long. Just going on all the time, little people wandering around with headphones on. But you see, this picture that I'm describing of music is one that actually is a means of representing and reflecting the nature of the triune God to the world. And we've taken that and we've turned that into something that is for amusement. I've actually heard people say, well, you know, the music at the beginning of the worship service is just to sort of get us in the mood so we can hear the sermon. Do you see how horrible that is? Look what we've done to music. We've turned it into some sort of entertainment, mood-altering drug. That's not what it was meant for at all. So we've debased it terribly. The connection between beauty, goodness, and truth, I think, is seen in a fellow named Hans Urs von Balthasar. Have you run across him? Von Balthasar was a Catholic theologian and a brilliant, brilliant writer. And one of the things he wrote in his book, Seeing the Form, it's called, Seeing the Form, A Theological Aesthetics. which I recommend to you. I mean, it's written by a Roman Catholic, so you understand that I, as a non-Roman, would have some difficulties with his theology. I'm not trying to give you all of him. But I think when he talks about aesthetics and applies a Christian worldview to these things, he does a brilliant job. He says this, quote, "Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision as do truth and goodness." We have to defend them, in other words, with the same sort of courage. "And she, beauty, will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with herself in an act of mysterious vengeance." So true. He says later on, "He who sneers at beauty, quote, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love." Now, do you see how that fits in? Truth, goodness, and beauty are one in God. Jesus never came and said, "I'll teach you the truth." He said, "I am the truth." He never said, "I'll teach you moral life." He never gave anybody that option. He said, "I am what goodness is. Eat me," he says. "Take me into yourself. I am what virtue is." Well, in the same way, he is what beauty is. Maybe you know Psalm 27. Psalm 27, verse 4, I think it is. David writes, "One thing I ask of the Lord, one thing I desire, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life." And most of us kind of stop there. But do you know what the next bit is? "To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord." The longing that we have for beauty in this life is not an accident. It's a very real and powerful thing. C.S. Lewis says that the reason that we long for things that are beautiful is that we are momentarily grasping our real situation. That is, that we are separated still, even as redeemed souls. We are not fully reunited with our God, who is the great satisfaction. At the end of Dante, the Paradiso. At the end of the Paradiso, when Dante sees God for the first time, looks into the eyes of God after all those three books, he says something like, I'm doing this from memory so I don't remember the quote exactly, but it's something like, "Once I looked into those eyes, I knew that there was never a reason to take my gaze away, because nothing I ever longed for was not there. Nothing I ever longed for in my life was to be found elsewhere." The longing that we have in our hearts for beauty is a longing that we have to be satisfied with God Himself. So, when we run across something beautiful in this world, it turns out to be a way for us to see through it to the God that made it. In other words, the things that are beautiful in this world are windows into heaven, if you want to think of it that way. Lewis tells a little parable about a fellow who is gardening, and he stops because he's pruning these roses and they're so beautiful, and he's overwhelmed with the beauty of these roses, and he stops and he says, "God, thank you for these roses. They are so beautiful. Thank you for the rose. It's such a graceful thing." And God speaks back to him and says, "You're welcome." Basically, "You're welcome. But," and they are beautiful. God agrees with him. They are. "But wait till you see an unfallen rose. And then, wait till you see an unfallen rose through unfallen eyes."
You see, because the beauty of God's creation and the ability for us to sense that beauty in this world are both broken by the fall. Not completely destroyed, but broken, shattered, made difficult to understand. And so you see, the reestablishment of a Christian aesthetic is a way for Christians, and this fits right into our theology, to stand against the effects of the fall. To gain back something of what it means to be a human being made in the image of God. Because you know, the ability to perceive the beautiful is not something that's given to anyone other than human beings. I mean, in this world. I don't know about angels. But you never see a grizzly bear sitting on the side of the Grand Canyon going, "Wow." Do you? It's just not in him to do. He walks along, yeah, sure, there's a hole there and there's food over here, and you know, no, it doesn't mean anything to him. You don't see animals sitting and listening to great music or looking at paintings and then discussing them or even arguing about them, which is what I'd love to see Christians start to do again, arguing about them. I hope Doug has sponsored a bit of an argument with his Thomas Kincaid remarks yesterday. The beauty of this world is a means for us to understand something of that which is going to one day be our full bore delight. So what it means to be human is to be able to represent and recognize that which is beautiful and simultaneously to create beautiful things ourselves. Including music. Well, the reason for that is that we as human beings are made in His image and He is a creator. So I think it's fine for us to encourage our artists in the church to make great art. Not secondary art, not bad, schlocky, kitschy art. You know why that's bad, by the way? Do you know why that's a bad thing? It's not just a matter of sort of personal preference. Yeah, I've seen, you know, Renoirs, and so I think that this is not so good art or something. It's first of all, that image of God question again. But it's because it debases the God that we actually are talking about. You see? If we take God and represent Him to the world with our art, which is what we're doing, I have a whole lecture about that too, because I think one of the ways to reach the postmodern world is now not so much to reason with them about the facts behind the resurrection, because that goes right by them, that doesn't move them anymore. But art and stories do move them. I think now is the time for apologists of the faith to actually take art up as their weapon and run with it. And that means, you see, we have to have rich lives of real art. We can't just sort of dabble in it on the side and create little figurines and cute little, you know what I mean? If the world is going to watch us and say, hey, what they've got is worthwhile, then they're going to actually have to see something. I mean, what they've got in their theology is worthwhile. They have to see some art and some rich life that's worthwhile. I'll tell you one quick story about that. Dr. Schaefer, Francis Schaefer, was once asked by a fellow who was in a big ministry what he could do differently. If I came to Schaefer and said, here's all the things we're doing these many Bible studies, we're going to this many places and doing our missions work, and this is happening. How can I better this? I want to do really well for the Lord. And Schaefer said to him this, stop eating on paper plates. Why would that make a difference? Paper plates. It's the way you live your life that speaks, as well as what you say. If you eat lunch and dinner on paper plates in an automobile so that you can get in time to the next Bible study that you're teaching, you have lost something of what it means to be human. What Schaefer said was, eat on real china plates with real utensils at a real table with a tablecloth and real flowers on the table, and after you're finished eating, wash the dishes. That's truth. Because you see, we live in a world that needs washing up. We need to live as though we understand the rejuvenating process that we're in. You see? Well, this, once you start thinking like that, then you start thinking art has a real vital place in your life. That's a whole different way of looking at things than a very pragmatic, frankly, pragmatic, which is, by the way, not a Christian term. Practical may be a Christian term, but pragmatism is not Christian. Changes your view. All right. Well, strayed a bit from my outline here, I suppose. The subjective side deals with the listener's response, and I think you should never, ever get in the way of that. I'm here to tell you that I'm all in favor of our having deep, mystical, inexplicable experiences with art. So I'm not trying to explain all that away. The subjective is real, it's there, it's a significant part of what we do. But just don't let the objective go by the wayside in order to have that. And there's a way, I think, to understand those things subjectively far better than we're doing. All right, I'm going to jump to the last of it here. The objective side deals with the work itself, and I think I've made that clear. You have 5 or 6 different specific things that you could study to better understand the objective side of music. And they are listed here. Rhythm, line, harmony, form, color. You could add another one, texture. And the definitions of those words are significant, and when you take those definitions and apply them to music, you begin to take apart what the music is, begin to understand the analysis of it, and be able to put it back together again, because you know you have to put it back together again. And then you can begin, that's really the grammar of understanding music. I'll throw out a title for you. Aaron Copland wrote a book called How to Listen to Music. It's a very good book, and it takes those elements and it breaks them down for you, and it helps you. If you're interested in teaching it to young people, there's a great way to start. If you're interested in learning about it yourself, he's a great way to start. One last thing I want to tell you, and that is this. I think what we have in our lexicon is the wrong definition of the word taste. And if we use the right definition of the word taste, we will find that it's the two sides of this, objective and subjective, can come back together again. In our fallen state, we have things that are objectively beautiful that we don't find any pleasure in. It's understandable. There are things that I could prove to you are really worthwhile, and you'd still go away saying, yeah, but it didn't move me. That's all right. Don't sweat it. There are also things that are subjectively really powerful and emotive and interesting and delightful to you personally that don't have any real objective beauty to them. That's all right, too. There are going to be some of those. Don't worry about it. But I think what we really need to do is start thinking, how can we join these two sides together? How can we learn to calibrate our sensibilities to appreciate what is truly good in something? That's taste. Taste is J.I. Packer said in one of his books, taste is a facet of wisdom. It's the ability to see what is fitting from what is not fitting. Keep that in mind. Most people think of taste as personal taste. I like blue, you like green. I like this kind of architecture, you like that kind. You know, I want to decorate my house in this way and that way. Taste means that. It's come to mean that. But if you look down the dictionary, 5 or 6 definitions, it still has something in there. Taste is the ability to discern that which is excellent from that which is not so excellent. And that's a word I'd like to recover. Okay. I've gone on long enough. If you've got questions, I'd be glad to stay and talk to you about them. But I hope this will inspire you to think more about the objective side and take it seriously that the work that we do in the arts is a significant work stating about the God that we love to the watching world. Thank you for your help.
All right. today. I'm